Earlier this month, Justin Potter, a writer for ZMag.org, who has reported on a variety of struggles from around the world, visited Winnipeg and gave three talks, as well as an interview with Black Mask. We're going to play excerpts from the interview and his two talks. His first talk was on Israel-Palestine, entitled, It Takes a Whole World to Starve a People. The talk began with a general assessment in the wake of the bombing of Gaza, and went on to talk about Canada's role in the conflict. During the recent siege, 1,324 Palestinians were killed, most of whom were civilians. 13 Israelis were also killed in the conflict, 4 by friendly fire, 3 of whom were civilians. Potter starts out talking about Israel's general approach in recent years in the occupied territories.
The entire strategy now is not to negotiate for peace, it's to manage conflict on an ongoing basis. It's to manage the war against the Palestinians so that it can last. It's the whole approach is to get the land, to continue to expand into Palestinian lands without the people, without having to control the people, without having to take responsibility for the people. So Gaza is controlled even though the settlers left. Gaza used to have Israeli settlers living inside it. In 2005, they left. But people of Gaza don't control their own borders. Israel controls their borders. The people of Gaza don't control economic comings and goings. Israel controls them. So Israel manages to continue to control the territories without taking any responsibility for their starvation or non-starvation, for the destruction of their economy, which Israel continues to do. And in Canada, unfortunately, in foreign policy matters, what Canada does in the world is generally what the United States wants Canada to do. And so even when you look at times when Canada has diverged from what the U.S. wanted, so in Vietnam, the U.S. was outright attacking the Vietnamese, and Canada was on this international control commission. But in fact, Canada was playing a very useful role for the United States in those international fora. It was acting as the U.S. representative in a lot of ways. When Canada sometimes acts as a good cop compared to the U.S. as bad cop. They favor diplomacy. They favor soft power. These are all parts of a multi-pronged approach, and their goals are always the same. The goals are always to support the U.S. in its corporate and state and imperial objectives. And I'll talk about a few other cases like Afghanistan and Haiti a little later. But one thing that for all these three electoral democracies that I've discussed, Israel and the US and Canada, they don't offer much to the Palestinians. At least when these countries elect officials, the results are accepted. That's not the case for the Palestinians. And this kind of contempt for democracy when the Palestinians choose their officials actually has incredibly dire consequences for this whole conflict. I mentioned the Israel's unilateral approach to these things, Israel's refusal to talk, its refusal to acknowledge that there's another party. That's one portion of it. Another portion is the entire world's agreement that Palestinians don't have the right to choose their leaders. So in 2006, when the Palestinians elected Hamas won the majority in the legislative elections. Canada was the first to cut relations. They were the first to impose sanctions. And they imposed an effective boycott on the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. And the Palestinians were desperate to try to break that boycott. They were willing to accept an undemocratic result. The Hamas was willing to say, okay, look, we won the elections, but we're gonna allow a power sharing arrangement with Fatah, which was the favorite elected government of the Palestinians, but Hamas was willing to share power with the people they had defeated electorally in a unity government. Nobody went for that. The whole world ignored that. And they continued to boycott Hamas. So the reason this is so important, the reason they want to impose this boycott on Hamas until there are several conditions that are met. There's three conditions that Condoleezza Rice said Hamas has to accept. Hamas has to renounce violence. Hamas has to comply with all previous agreements with Israel that were signed by Fatah, that were signed by the people they ousted. And Hamas has to recognize Israel's existence. Okay, this is a complete disparity. There are no such conditions imposed on Israel. Imagine if the United States told the incoming Israeli government, which was just elected, if there were any symmetry in this world, this is what would happen. The U.S. would say, okay, you've just elected a government. For us to recognize this government, the Israeli government that comes in, whether it's Netanyahu or Livni, they have to accept all previous agreements with the Palestinians, including agreements about the two-state solution. They have to recognize the existence of a Palestinian state, and they have to renounce violence. I don't know how this sounds to you, but this is utterly unfathomable. This would mean Israel would have to completely change everything that it does. To renounce violence against the Palestinians would be to discard the main element of their strategy. They'd have to discard their assassination policy, and they'd have to end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. They'd have to renounce all these bombing raids. And there's no way the U.S. would do that. So I think the highest priority in terms of getting a message out, or in terms of trying to change at least some sections of Canadian society and institutions' opinions on something, is to get them to say, okay, Palestinians have the right to choose their leaders, and we do not have the right to boycott the Palestinians, and neither does Israel. Because of this apartheid analogy and this kind of apartheid analysis, there's a growing movement, small, but in different parts of Europe and in some parts of Canada, even some unions in Canada have adopted resolutions to boycott and divest and sanction Israel until it complies with international law, dismantles the wall, dismantles the settlements, changes its approach to the Palestinians, to do this campaign, boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, against Israel. The truth is, there's a boycott and divestment and sanctions campaign that's incredibly effective going on right now against the Palestinians. And that's why the title of this talk, It Takes the Whole World to Starve a People. It is incredible what the Palestinians have been doing and how resilient they've been in the face of this campaign against them. When the Israelis decided to totally seal Gaza off, it's surrounded on three sides by electric fence, people know this, and then there's a sea coast that's patrolled by Israeli warships, who sometimes shell the beach and kill people in Gaza regularly, and so on. So it's totally sealed in. And when it became totally sealed in, the Hamas government, which has a network of mosques and community centers and so on, I mean, the thing about Hamas is, the other thing people don't realize, it's not like Al-Qaeda. It's not some kind of foreign authoritarian organization that rules through terror. It's just the people of the camps. It's the leadership in the camps, and they live like the people in the camps. They're not enriching themselves. They're not, and that was the source of their popularity. They were resisting. They were living. They weren't enriching themselves, and they were not willing to give up and surrender. And that's why they're popular, and that's why the Israelis hate them so much. And so it's not so much the Hamas network that's keeping people alive. It's the Palestinian traditions of hospitality and social cohesion and sharing and mutual aid, which have kept people alive in spite of deliberate attempts to destroy their economy and their society. If you read Sarah Roy, Sarah Roy is a Harvard political economist who's written on Gaza, the political economy of de-development, and how the Israelis have deliberately destroyed the economy of Gaza.
That was Justin Poder speaking at the Mondragon on February the 11th. The day after that talk was given, it was announced that Hampshire College in Massachusetts had become the first U.S. college or university to divest from companies on the grounds of their involvement in the Israeli occupation of Palestine. 32 years ago, Hampshire College was the first U.S. college to divest from apartheid South Africa. Justin Poder spoke again on Winnipeg on the 12th about the current global economic meltdown. He talks about a book published in 2000, before the collapse, praising the virtues of the financial economy, and examines their claims of what makes it so great.
And then they say, here's a couple of examples of how fantastic the expansion of the financial economy over all areas of economic life is. The two most innovative things that they had offered as examples in 2000 were Enron and mortgage-backed securities. It doesn't get better than this, right, to have them make the argument for it just before it all goes to hell. But when it did go to hell, we had yet another argument against markets. And I don't mean against markets in principle, I mean against the idea that things are run according to markets, because they're not. In Toronto, a lot of people, a lot of activist groups and labor groups are looking back to the 30s and they're saying, oh, you know, this depression could be a lot like the 30s and we should look at how people dealt with it in the 30s. I actually think there are better examples. I actually think that if the downturn kind of continues, one place to look for both survival strategies and parallels is Argentina in 2001 through 2003. They had a profound kind of economic crisis and depression, and they came up with, and their society in a lot of ways is similar. Argentina is not one of the poorest of the poor countries. It's actually one of the more first world of the Latin American countries. And in many ways, including the kind of atomization and lack of social cohesion that we have here in North America, they had a lot of that there. It was broken. A lot of it was broken by years of dictatorship. A lot of it was broken by consumerism and so on. So they had there's a lot of similarities. But people did manage to find each other and develop several interesting survival strategies during that period. And there were four that come to mind. And they were the community assemblies, where people kind of coordinated all kinds of social and public activities. The piqueteros, that were demonstrations of a physical presence to make demands on, mainly on the government, for kind of welfare and basic rights. And then the occupied factories, where you had capital flight, and the owners of these factories would leave, and the workers would take them over and use them. And after some time, these occupied factories would start to relate to each other through an alternative currency system as well. They called it the trueque, which was a kind of a barter system. But they would link directly with each other because they couldn't actually get the money. So So sometimes you had everything else. You had the resources, the facilities, the workers, the skills, but not the actual money. And you could, there are ways to kind of get around that. And there have been historically in Argentina, they found a few of those in Argentina as well.
When we spoke with Justin Poder, we asked about free software, another topic he's written about.
You've written about free software movement now and again. I have a couple questions about that, but first of all, if you want to describe a little bit for people listening who might not have heard of the free software movement before, what exactly, or even just generally sketch what that means.
Yeah. On free software stuff, I generally follow Richard Stallman, because there's a lot of different takes on it. There's open source, but Stallman insists on very specific wording for things. So you can't call it Linux, you have to call it GNU plus Linux. Mm-hmm. You can't call it open source, you have to call it free software. And the way Stallman talks about it is in terms of the four freedoms, 0 through 3. Mm-hmm. And so any software, you should be able to look at the code, look at the source code, modify it, copy it, and share it. I think those are the freedoms. And the idea is that there's something about information. I mean, the difference between information and another kind of thing, like a cookie. If I give you a cookie, I no longer have the cookie. Mm-hmm. If I give you a recipe, I still have the recipe. And so sharing information is different from sharing goods. And stealing the whole concept of stealing information is kind of a bankrupt notion, because you can't steal it from somebody because they still have it after you've mm-hmm. stolen it. And so all of the legal and political and governmental mechanisms that are in place to prevent the stealing of information and to control information are pushing against the nature of information, and also pushing against democracy, and pushing against transparency, and pushing against efficiency mm-hmm. from the point of view of people who develop software, or scientists, or anybody who's interested in any of these things, culture, art. These things should be free, and people should be able to build on them, and people should be able to take them and grow from them. The way I understand free software as far as social movements go, I just think it's I think there's a natural fit, because the alternative to using free software and helping to be part of a community that develops it and so on is to use corporate software, and which gets you into the politics of trying to control information. And having capitalism is like that. Mm-hmm. Markets are like that. If you're in a market, you have to try to control. You have to try to restrict access to whatever it is you're selling in order to force people to pay for it, in the first place. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to do that, if you don't want to be part of that whole process, then in the realm of information, you're into the free software movement. Mm-hmm.
You were just saying that there was kind of a natural fit between free software, the free software movement, and other social movements. But it seems like, of the things you write about, it's the least linked to other, like, social movements and stuff. And I wonder if there's a reason why you think that is, what the roadblocks are, and what capacity there is for building more cooperation.
I think it has a lot to do with the nature of the free software movement, honestly. It's similar to the environmental movement, where they think, a lot of the leaders think that if they portray themselves as radical, or if they associate with one side or the other of various social struggles, which they see as social disputes, mm-hmm. Then they're going to lose potential audiences, allies, credibility. So which is also part of the split between free software and open source people, who are advocating the same kind of software model, but the open source people say this is not a movement, this is not a social movement, it's just a software development model.
You know, you could have centralized labs and copyright protections, or you can have a decentralized model of software development, and it gives you better results. So they don't want to get into the ethical aspects or the social consequences. And free software people are a little more sensitive, but you know, and it's something you can understand. You know, Richard Stallman, I think, is much more of an activist in his personal behavior than through GNU, through his mm-hmm. free software project. If you look at his blog, he's talking about and supporting all kinds of activist movements, but not through GNU, and that's because he wants to keep that about stick to the issue, right? Mm-hmm. And single issue anything has lots of adherents, and in some ways, you know, it's appealing to say, well, we might be able to get everybody if we just stick to this one issue. If we stick to the feminist women's issue, then we should be able to get people regardless of how they feel about capitalism or regardless of how they feel about race and so on. Mm-hmm. In the real world, I don't think it works that way. And you end up getting... If you kind of dilute your politics, I guess now I'm thinking more of the environmental movement than anything else. If you remove the justice kind of component, what ends up happening is you end up coming to a misguided idea of who the enemy is and what you're actually up against. And you think that you can convince rich people, or you think you can convince corporations to do things in this eco-friendly way, when the fundamental basis of what corporations do is to try to turn nature into money, you know? And that's not something that can be done in a eco-friendly way. So... I think that's part of it. I think it's kind of single issue politics, and its limitations, and you know, the alternative to single issue politics isn't that everybody automatically knows everything about every issue. It's messy coalitions where people have conflicts mm-hmm. and gradually learn from each other. So that's really what I am advocating here. I think some kind of a better relationship between free software people and other kinds of movement people. And I actually think that's happening, and I think it's been happening more and more, and a lot of activist websites now use free software. And so I think it's something that's going on and something that's moving in good directions.
We also had the chance to ask him about anti-civilization anarchist Derek Jensen. Potter has written positively of Jensen, and we asked whether he thought the anti-civilization politics of his book, Endgame, were in any way compatible with the social anarchist tradition.
Well, my reaction to Jensen's book was, I found him more convincing than I wished I did. Because his definition of civilization, I think, is I mean, he defines everything. He's very precise in that sense. He says civilization is any situation where you're taking resources from one area for use by another. So in order to do that, you require some kind of apparatus of force. You can't do it without some kind of violence, doing violence to nature, doing violence to people who live there. And so once you have started onto that path, its destruction is inevitable. And you can do that as... You could call yourself a socialist society and probably do that. There hasn't been... And he says there hasn't been a society since civilization started that hasn't done these things. And so... So I don't know how much we know about non-civilized
societies. I find that whenever I read people talk, anthropologists or people who make points about how wonderful non-civilized societies are or how awful non-civilized societies are, I don't buy them. I feel like if they are really so different from what we are and how we conceive of the world, and how, then we're probably not able to evaluate them objectively. If they're not so different, well, then we're able to make comparisons, and then the political points are not there to be made, because you can't appeal to some fantastical, either fantastically horrid, nasty, brutish, short, uncivilized existence, or some utopian uncivilized existence. So when the anti-civilization argument relies on how wonderful non-civilized life is, then it's I don't think it's a very useful argument. Mm-hmm. And he does that a little bit, I think, if I remember correctly. Yeah, but he mostly makes the argument on how awful civilization is. Mm-hmm. And I do think that civilization, you know, patriarchy, caste, feudalism, all of these forced, really negative and oppressive forces came before capitalism and persist often. Slavery, there are all these incredibly brutal oppressions that have been on the scene for a lot longer than capitalism has. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, and they were destructive of nature, they were destructive of the natural environment, and in that sense, I think what Jensen is saying is fair. Now, what's the relationship between that and capitalism? Well, I think I don't want to speak for Jensen, but I think he would just say that capitalism is the flowering of that dynamic into ever more efficient and brutal forms. I mean he's certainly, his anti-civilization arguments take him in my view all the right directions. He's anti-patriarchy, he's anti, you know, homophobia, he's anti-racist, and he's anti-capitalist. So it's just a little, in some ways, a little deeper and therefore more scary, because his conclusions are that it's all going to collapse and lots of people are going to die and it's inevitable, and the only thing to do is to try to hasten that collapse, because the sooner it happens, the better off, the more nature there'll be. And the only other thing to do is to hasten the collapse. Yeah, and I guess to try to survive, keep enclaves of something alive. But I think he's mostly focused on trying to speed up the collapse. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that that's not something I'm interested in doing. That's not a strategy that I'm interested in taking. And that's, yeah, and I suppose that's where I diverge from that analysis. Maybe I'm not, you know, he says this himself. He says if he was more courageous, he wouldn't be writing. He'd be blowing up dams or whatever. And I don't know whether it's easy for me to rationalize and say, well, I don't know whether this is because I'm not courageous enough to accept the full conclusions of what he's saying, or whether it's a genuine analytical disagreement that mm-hmm. the thing to do right now is to hasten the collapse, which I think is going to take, if it all does collapse, it's going to take all of us with it, and I don't see that as a good thing.
That was Justin Potter, who was in Winnipeg earlier this month and who writes for ZMag.org. He also has a blog at killingtrain.com. The segment you just heard was produced for Black Mask by Macho Filipovich.